Lasting peace cannot be achieved unless large population groups find ways in which to break out of poverty.
With those words, the Nobel Committee awarded the 2006 Peace Prize to Muhammad Yunus. His ideas on microlending had changed lives in his native country, Bangladesh, and beyond. Now, Muhammad Yunus has written about his next big idea in a new book called Creating a World Without Poverty, Social Business, and the Future of Capitalism. Muhammad Yunus joins me now. Thank you very much for coming into our studio.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
We know you for your work on microfinance. You shared the Nobel Peace Prize with the Grameen Bank. What is this next idea of yours? What is a social business?
If you look at it, the business world, you imagine people being some kind of a money-making machine. All they do in the world of business is make money for themselves. But the human being, to me, is much bigger than that. Human being is also a caring human being, sharing human being, wants to make a difference in the world. That thing is not considered within the framework of economic theory of business. So I'm saying this is something missing, and it created a lot of problems for us in the society. So I want to put it back, have the whole human being included into the economic theory. So I'm saying there should be at least two kinds of businesses, business as usual to make money and the business to do good without any personal benefit out of it. And I'm calling it social business. Social business is a non-loss, non-dividend company with a social objective.
How is it different from a non-profit organization which does make money but just plows it back into the business?
Non-profit by definition is a charity organization. In a non-profit, you can give your money and you can't take it back. So I'm talking about a business where I own it. It's my business and I'm the investor. But I don't want to take any profit out of it. So the bottom line in social business is how much impact I have made on the society by doing that, not how much money I made, because I decided the money I'll make is zero. I can take back my investment money. If I put $1 million into my business, I can gradually take my $1 million back, not a penny more.
It sounds like it requires the investors to value those social goals as much as or more than making a profit. What makes you think that that's as much of an incentive for investors as making a profit on their money?
We do it all the time, but we don't notice it. When you are in politics, you dedicate yourself. In religion, you do it all the time. You want to do good. You want to do so many good other things. But nobody questions that. But why suddenly economics is different? It's not different.
Let's talk about your experiment with the yogurt company, known globally as Danone, but here in the United States, Danone.
Yeah.
Tell me about this experiment with Grameen Danone.
We tried to create a social business. It's a chance meeting. I had a discussion with the chairman of Danone, and I proposed to him, why don't we create a Grameen Danone company in Bangladesh, which will produce yogurt, but this will be a very special kind of yogurt. There are millions of children who are malnourished in Bangladesh. So we take the missing micronutrients in these children and put it into the yogurt and let these children eat this yogurt, and Danone agreed right away.
One of the adjustments you've made to the business side is that Danone is now paying a dividend on the investment that investors have put into Grameen Danone. That is completely counter to your original idea of social business.
A shareholder can say, why are you using our money into a project which doesn't produce any dividend for us? So they went ahead and circulated this resolution that whenever Danone company gives you a dividend, would you care to put a little money into a tiny little fund here where you'll promise that you're not interested in getting dividend?
I see. Another social business that you have worked to set up is Grameen Telecom. This is the joint venture between Grameen Bank
and Telenor,
the Norwegian phone company. It seems like there's been a hitch.
Yeah.
Tell me about what's happened with Telenor.
We had a joint venture with Telenor and a company that we created called Grameen Telecom to create a cell phone company called Grameen Phone. So at the point where we're making the joint venture agreement, we put a clause that after the company is born and operation started, after 6 years, Telenor will sell the shares to Grameen Telecom so that Grameen Telecom become the majority shareholders of Grameen Phone. So we thought it's very safe, very nicely done. Because our intention was Grameen Phone will ultimately become a social business, meaning that majority shareholders will be the poor women in Bangladesh, like Grameen borrowers.
What happened?
After the 6 years were gone, when we asked Telenor to sell the shares, they said, no, we are not going to sell the share. In the meantime, Grameen Phone became a big company and they're making a lot of profit.
So Hundreds of millions of dollars.
That's right. They became very interested in keeping it.
It seems like here again, it comes down to once the company was making profits, the shareholders' interests rule the day.
It's not that it's the mechanism by which shareholders' opinions are reflected in the company policy. That's where at fault. Shareholders are not doing that. They don't want to hang on to something which is supposed to go to the poor people. They feel embarrassed about it. But somehow the company doesn't feel that way. Company feels that we have to show our result. This is something that we want to maintain.
Well, I guess my larger question, the bigger picture seems to be, it's a beautiful idea, this idea of social business. The Grameen Danone and in the Grameen Telecom case, they've both been very much affected by traditional capitalist market forces, meaning the investors, the shareholders in the
end. Because we live in the world where all these rules and procedures made for one type of company. Once you say that this is a good idea, then all the rules will come in this direction. So new legal framework will be built.
I wonder if you think profit motive business in specifically China, Taiwan, these places, haven't they done as much or more as your groups for the cause of poverty?
These are not separate issues. Microcredit doesn't say you stop the economy. We'll take care of everything else. No. If you didn't have the people at the bottom hitched into the economy, they will be staying where they are. So the gap between the people who are moving at a high speed and the people who are at the zero speed will be widened. So microcredit brings in that kind of hitching mechanism.
Mohamed Yunus, I want to read something from your book. It says, perhaps to some, the idea of social business sounds purely fanciful, a fantasy of a world that can never be. But why? Who has given the ultimate verdict that people are motivated only by money, that the desire to do great things for the world can't be just as powerful a driving force in human behavior? Do you have any indication that this dream of a social business could actually be a reality in our markets?
I know for sure it will be a reality because the urge is very strong among people. They want to do things for other people, they want to feel that they are significant, they made a contribution in the world. So as long as that urge will be in the persons, this will be happening. Because today I cannot express that urge into business world. I have to take that urge either to politics or to charity or to something else. So I said this is a kind of a shortcoming, a lapse in our theoretical framework. So I'm just trying to correct that by bringing this piece into the picture and making it closer to the reality than what it has been.
Mohamed Yunus, the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize winner. His new book is called Creating a World Without Poverty, Social Business and the Future of Capitalism. Sir, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And there's an excerpt from Mohamed Yunus's book about a surprising meeting he had with a multinational company at npr.org/books.
Imagine if you could put 30,000 years of art on your coffee table. Well, thanks to Phaedon Publishers, you can. Their new book tells the story of human creativity around the world from 28,000 BC to the present. It weighs 13 pounds and features 1,000 pieces of art. Amanda Renshaw is the editorial director for 30,000 Years of Art. Here's an essay in which she describes a striking example of Saharan rock art in Niger that dates back to 4,000 BC.
The Sahara Desert isn't the first place you might expect to find giraffes. But if you're in the Niger and you head towards the Air Mountains and then go west to one particular rocky outcrop, this is exactly what you will find. Engraved on a gently sloping rock face known as the Dabu Rock, there are hundreds of them. These graceful animals are around 20 feet tall and must have taken a certain amount of skill to make. However, we know very, very little about who made them. We can only guess that this specific site was chosen because of the way the rock slopes, so that at certain times of the day, when the sun is low in the sky, dramatic shadows form on the red sandstone, displaying the mighty figures to their best advantage.
Unlike the typical art book organized by stylistic themes or epochs, 30,000 Years of Art is in strict chronological order. But open the book anywhere, and you'll see a work of art on the left page and one on the right. Although the works were created at the same time, they came from different places and different cultures. For example, early in the book, on the left page, there's a sculpture of a man with a lion's head, dating from 28,000 BC in what is now Germany. On the right, there's a stone figure of a woman found in Austria, dated 25,000 BC. Amanda Renshaw.
The Lion Man is interesting. It was very difficult to find a figure of a man that existed, a human man with a human head. There are many figures from that period of women, but very few of men. And I think that this hybrid man-lion is very interesting in that how did we perceive ourselves all those millennia ago? It's interesting that women are very, very lifelike in the sculptures. They're very, very lifelike, and the men aren't. So there's something there about power, about perhaps domination of man, I would imagine, and a hunter, man the hunter. And that's how the book starts, with a typical image of how man may have been perceived and woman.
Talk about some of the more surprising entries. On page 792, there's a wine cup that was made for the Shah who built the Taj Mahal. But on the opposite page is this famous painting by Velazquez, Las Meninas. That must have surprised you.
Yes, I love that spread. It's great. I think it's a fantastic spread, and it really encapsulates what the book is about. About 350 years ago, an artist, yes, called Diego Velazquez, was painting a family portrait for the king, King Philip II of Spain. And this painting was called Las Meninas. And it's considered one of the masterpieces of Western art. It's an enormous canvas. It measures about 10 feet high by, I think, 9 feet wide. And it shows Philip II of Spain's blonde-haired daughter, the Infanta Margarita, who's at the center of the composition. And she's in this beautiful white dress with a blue and red trim. And she's surrounded by her attendants and maids all fussing over her. And reflected in the mirror on the far wall at the back of the painting are Infanta Margarita's parents, the king and queen. And in addition to all these members of the royal family and different attendants, on the left-hand side of the picture, there is somebody standing very proud, holding a paintbrush in one hand and a palette in the other, and this is Velazquez. Velazquez himself, he included himself in this royal family portrait. And I think it was a very, very conscious decision that he made to emphasize his importance within the royal family and his social standing and the importance of the status of the artist in 17th century Spain. Now, on that opposite page, while you have this beautiful, delicate wine cup, while Velazquez was being feted as a great and important painter in Spain, 4,500 miles away in India, a man whose name we will probably never know was crouched on the floor of a workshop in India, and with also incredible skill and dexterity, he carved an exquisitely delicate cup, which is small enough to hold comfortably in the palm of your hand. So size is very different. Status of the artist is very different. It's made of very precious white jade. It has a goat's head for a handle and a stand that's in the sort of shape of a lotus flower. It's translucent, it's a beautiful vessel, and it was also destined for one of the world's most powerful leaders at the time. I mean, you said this was the man who created the Shah Jahan, was the man who created the Taj Mahal. So there are two extremely different things that were made at the same time, both for very, very important rulers.
To just look at the intricacy of detail in each one of these different pieces of art, I mean, the detail on this very small piece of jade is as intricate as the detail in Velazquez's masterpiece.
Absolutely. And I think that you only know that by seeing them together, because normally you would never, ever consider them in the same book, let alone the same pair of pages opposite each other.
I'm moving to the 19th century now, and the very famous painting by Edvard Munch, The Scream, where, mm-hmm. you know, you have that elongated head with the two hands up against it in the open mouth. This one is juxtaposed with a mask from Equatorial Guinea. And the one thing I can find in common is that they both have elongated faces.
Yes, well, there was a period in Western art when a lot of artists, expressionists, and Munch was one of the first expressionists, and also Picasso did the same thing. They were very interested in looking at African sculpture. And art historians have often described how the Munch comes from the pain and the angst that is also can be found in African masks. And we were very lucky that when we made the chronological mix, that these two actually fell on the same spread. So they're there opposite each other when you open the book. So the subject matter is in a way very similar, but of course the painting is very expressionistic. The brushstrokes are very rough and wild, and the colour is extreme. And the Equatorial Guinea mask is extremely minimal and calm. So two things that actually physically look very, very similar, but again, they're treated in very, very different ways.
Amanda Renshaw, editorial director of the book 30,000 Years of Art, published by Phaidon. We end with her essay about a tiny Middle Eastern sculpture dating back from 2500 BC.
With the head of a lioness and the muscular body of an Amazonian woman, this tiny, hard limestone sculpture is small enough to fit comfortably in your hand. At around 3 1/4 inches tall, its size does nothing to reduce its power and physical presence. This sculpture was found at an archaeological site near Baghdad in Iraq. It seems that she was created by the Proto-Elamite culture who lived in what was then Mesopotamia and is now Iran. This hybrid of human and feline features rears up on her hind legs. She stands with her front paws clenched together over her muscular torso, her head turned in profile, gazing impassively over her heavy left shoulder. This pose, and the holes drilled into the back of her head, suggests that she was designed to be worn around the neck, perhaps as a charm to ward off evil spirits. For some 60 years, the lioness has been on display at the Brooklyn Museum of Art. However, late in 2007, she was offered for sale at auction and sold for $57 million, making her the most expensive sculpture sold at auction, fitting for a piece described by one art historian as the finest sculpture on earth.
You can see images from 30,000 Years of Art and hear more essays from Amanda Renshaw at our website, npr.org.
It's the start of a brand spanking new year, and we thought it would be a good time to look at other beginnings. For instance, did you know that Pepsi Cola began life as the far more ordinary sounding Brad's drink? Or that the man who helped develop the lie detector test also created Wonder Woman? These tasty tidbits come from the book In the Beginning, From Big Hair to the Big Bang, Mental Floss presents a mouthwatering guide to the origins of everything. Will Pearson is an editor of Mental Floss magazine, and he joins me now. How are you?
I'm doing well, Andrea. Thanks.
Good. So, okay,
First things first, this may be an obvious question, but what about the origins of this book? How did you start writing this book?
We get so many questions from readers about origins that eventually it became a no-brainer. From Mental Floss magazine, people ask us questions all the time. And finally, we decided, you know, we've got about 100 or 200 of these, so we need to put these into a book and add some others with curious things of our own.
And we should say that for those who haven't seen it, Mental Floss magazine is sort of a magazine that answers weird questions and thinks about sort of odd things.
is that one fair way to put it. We look at it as a way to blur the lines between education and entertainment. It's a way to look back and learn the things you wish you'd learned in school.
Okay, so I wish I learned this in school. The creator of Wonder Woman, William Moulton Marston. He sounds like quite a character.
Yeah, he does. And researching this, we learned, you know, we kind of think of Wonder Woman as this great feminist character, but his original intentions with Wonder Woman was actually to create a character that would show women how to be both active but also submissive and peace-loving at the same time. So not exactly what people expected.
Barf. That's what I have to
exactly.
say about
it. I'm with you on that.
And while we're on this track of talking about women and their place, let's talk about the dishwasher. This was actually designed in the early 1900s, I read in your book. The first model came out in 1914, and it was invented, this Rube Goldberg sort of contraption was invented by a woman.
That's true. And not a woman that you might expect. It was, you know, it's hard to feel sorry for Josephine Cochran, given the problems most people faced in her day, poverty, work schedules, poor health, whatever it may have been. Josephine, on the other hand, was a very rich socialite. And her main problem was that it was hard to find good help. She was a pretty well-known socialite, would entertain many people. And what would happen is her servants were breaking her dishes on a regular basis. And this frustrated Josephine. She decided to take matters into her own hands. So she went out to the woodshed behind her house and invented this contraption, which surprisingly, when you look at the contraption she invented, had many of the same features that the dishwasher has today, with the wire sticking up where you would place each of the dishes. Worked pretty well. The only problem, had a hard time catching on, because when they interviewed women of the time, they actually found, at least their answer was, that they enjoyed washing the dishes themselves. I have a hard time believing that, but it took many decades before it actually caught on.
Fascinating. All right, I want to talk about my own personal torture here, the diet. For those of us swearing at this time of the year to start eating better and you know, cut out all the sweets and stuff like that, tell us about the origins of this grave torture.
Well, you know, it turns out dieting wasn't exactly a concern of our ancestors. For them, the main problem was actually getting more carbs, fat, and sugar, not less. Well, that's why, in looking back, the first person we could find to go on a recorded weight loss program was actually England's William the First, better known as William the Conqueror. And by all accounts, he's the fattest person to lead a major country until President Taft got stuck in a bathtub. So to cut his waistline, he adopted a liquid diet, which you should read as a liquor diet. So for the better part of a year, he attempted to subsist on nothing but alcohol, and it worked much better than you might expect, and he was eventually able to ride again.
Well, I imagine if he was drinking something like beer, I mean, that's made of grain, right? So it's not like straight, you know, vodka or something, right?
You know, yeah, and I'm not sure what exactly these drinks were that he was taking in, but somehow it worked. I guess it's kind of one of the early Atkins-like diets.
Will Pearson is one of the editors of Mental Floss magazine. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Andrea.
From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. In 1996, Carol Gilligan was named one of Time magazine's 25 most influential Americans. Her pioneering work in gender studies and psychology changed the way society views women. After her revolutionary book, In a Different Voice, was published in 1982, women finally began to be included in research studies in education and medicine, among other disciplines. Gilligan became the first chair of Harvard University's Gender Studies program. She's currently a professor at New York University, and she's written her first novel, Kira, which will be published this Tuesday. Carol Gilligan is in our New York bureau. Welcome.
Thank you, Leanne.
Give us a brief thumbnail biography. Who's Kira?
Kira is an architect. She's an urban designer She's a woman who grew up in Cyprus, and she's, at the time the novel opens, she's living in Cambridge in Boston, and she has this opportunity to design a new city on one of the islands off the coast of Massachusetts.
There is another character that plays an important part in the plot, Andreas. Who is he?
Andreas is a theater director, an opera director, who does these very inventive productions of operas. And he also has come out of Europe. And both these people are embarked in trying to make changes in the world. They're creative, artistic people. And neither intends to fall in love. So that's where the novel starts, is when they meet each other.
And fall in love.
And fall in love, yes.
And leave.
Yes. Well, they fall in love with each other, which is just a huge risk for both of them, because they've both come out of a history where his wife has disappeared in Budapest. She was presumably arrested and killed, and her husband had been shot. So for the two of them, to fall in love again, it's a huge risk for them. And at a certain point, Andreas abruptly leaves and goes back to Budapest. And then Kira is left with the question, was it real? What happened between them?
What was the inspiration for your plot?
I was reading the New York Times Book Review one Sunday and a review of a new translation of Virgil's Aeneid. And the reviewer singled out this passage in the underworld where Aeneas goes in search of his father and comes upon Dido. And he says to her, I could not believe I would hurt you so terribly by going. And I thought, how come he didn't know that? How could such a sensitive, intelligent man not know the effects of his action on someone he loved? And then for the woman involved, how crazy making that kind of experience is when what she's experienced, what she's known in her body is suddenly called into question. Was it true? Was it real? I thought, how would this play out in a contemporary situation? Because, you know, I knew from when I started that Kira was not going to kill herself. I mean, she wasn't going to do what Virgil's Dido does. And being a modern woman, I thought, she's going to end up in therapy, you know.
With Kira and Andreas both being affected by, in Andreas's case, the disappearance of his wife during the Hungarian protests while the Soviets were still in Hungary, and for Kira to lose her husband, it was during the conflicts in Cyprus, and her husband was shot by her half-brother. So both of them have lost a spouse to difficult and dramatic circumstances. So in some respects, they're both in the same place, and they're both afraid of getting involved in a relationship because they are afraid about how it's going to end. Was the idea, to a certain extent, by putting them both in the same place, to explore how a man and how a woman would react differently to that situation?
Oh, if I took out the word differently, it would be exactly it. I was interested in how a man and a woman, how these two people would respond to being in some sense captive of that kind of a terrible past. And so many people's lives in this time have been shattered by similar kinds of losses and violence. And how do they go on from that point and take the risk of loving again and learn to trust? Those were the questions. How do you get out of that kind of old story? That's the question that interested me.
A lot of opera occurs, mainly because Andreas is a conductor and he works with opera. And he and Kira play this little game where they go to some of the main plots of, you know, both Shakespeare and opera, and they play this what-if game. You know?
Oh, right. The game of change the ending.
Change the ending. That somehow works into their own relationship. They don't see it, but it's sort of, what would happen if?
Do you want to know one of the oddest things is that when I wrote that, I had no idea of how, in a way, it's a little microcosm of the whole novel. And it's only recently that I thought, yeah, that's exactly what they're trying to do. You know, they've come out of this terrible history, and they don't want to repeat it, but that means you have to find the place where you can move in a different direction. And that's really what they struggle with one another, and it's also what they're both doing in their work.
You've made it clear that this book was written by the fiction writer Carol Gilligan, not the academic Carol Gilligan. But I wonder, how do you think the academic Carol Gilligan would react to what the fiction writer Carol Gilligan has done?
I would think the academic Carol Gilligan would be delighted by this. I mean, first of all, she'd be delighted that the fiction writer took the risk. And the characters in the novel would interest her. I think she'd go, This is where the two start to coalesce, Leanne, this division. Because the questions that interest me about people's lives and the risks people take and don't take and what enables people to, you know, do the things that they love and that kind of boldness that's in both Kira and Andreas, and also the fear and the conflicts. She would appreciate the freedom of the novel. I mean, the fact that you can use metaphors to capture, you know, emotions that are so complicated and layered. I don't feel an internal division in myself between these two parts of myself. I've really enjoyed doing both kinds of writing.
Carol Gilligan. Her first novel, Kira, is published by Random House on Tuesday, January 15th. She joined us from our New York bureau. Thanks so much, Carol.
Thank you, Leanne. It's just been a pleasure.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris. America has stood as the world's dominant superpower for at least half a century, some would argue longer. But in the 21st century, several global powers, including China and Russia, are on the rise. A new book says this growth could actually make the U.S. stronger and safer. That book is called The Next American Century: How the U.S. Can Thrive as Other Powers Rise. It's written by Nina Hachigian and Mona Sutphin. Both were foreign policy experts in the Clinton administration. Sutphin argues that America can no longer afford to go it alone.
Primacy really doesn't deliver results. If you look, we have been the sole superpower now since the end of the Cold War. But it turns out that's led us into a war in Iraq. It's led us into questionable policies here and there, created lots of potential enemies around the world. And then finally, most importantly, if we're telling the world we have to be the sole superpower, the strongest power by any margin, you encourage other countries to try to knock us off of that mantle.
You know, it sounds in listening to this that you're almost advocating a weaker U.S.
Absolutely not. This is Nina. No, absolutely not. In fact, a central message of our book is that we have to reinvest in American strength and that we have to change the country that we actually have the power to change, and that's the U.S. And we have to work hard on fixing some of our domestic problems at home in order to thrive in an era with bigger powers. If we say that we have to always be the strongest power by a given fixed margin, Mona's absolutely right. We're encouraging other countries to see power as a zero-sum game, and it's just not anymore. Just look at the example of North Korea. We cannot, without China's deep involvement, roll back North Korea's nuclear program.
But, you know, the power can be used in many ways. And when it comes to a country like North Korea, sometimes it is more beneficial to take a much more aggressive stand. I mean, that seems to have worked at least to some degree with the current administration.
There's two issues. There's the carrot and the stick, and then it's working with the other powers. I mean, if we can get together with, this is Nina, if we can get together with China and Russia and Japan and South Korea and be tough on North Korea, then it very well might work. And in fact, it did work after they tested. China voted for tough UN sanctions against North Korea, something that they've never done before.
Actually, and this is Mona, to that point, I mean, the Bush administration was talking tough, but they were doing it alone and it wasn't getting them anywhere. In fact, you know, the deal that they've struck now with the North Koreans is more or less the same place that we were, you know, 7 years ago. So had they been engaging with the other major powers all along, perhaps we could have gotten to this result 2 years ago before they managed to produce enough fissile material for multiple weapons.
Nina, you say that that when you talk about rising powers, that America's fear of growth in countries like China and India is more damaging to the U.S. than the growth itself.
That's right. And that's because we really need to work with these powers, that for security reasons, for economic reasons, that we are much better off if we are thinking of them as on our team, basically. I mean, it doesn't mean that we aren't going to have great disagreements, and they could be profound disagreements, but basically they are our teammates.
Is that a hard sell? The Russians are our teammates?
Yes, particularly now, that is a hard sell. But the fact is that they are on some important issues. We will have all kinds of disagreements with them, but they are the co-founder and co-leader of a group of 50 countries that are trying to keep nuclear material out of the hands of terrorists.
Of course, right now, today, right, Russia and China and India are indisputably on the rise. But if you go back just 20 years in our history, you can track. I mean, we started in the late 80s, and obviously the Soviet Union was a big threat. Then it was Japan. Then it was Germany. Then it was the EU. Then the EU fell off. Germany fell off. Then China came on. India has popped up on the scene. Russia is now back in play. So, you know, it is true that these powers are growing, but they may not rise at the same trajectory forever. And the key point for us is when you look at the threats that could kill lots of Americans today, those threats are not emanating from these major powers. Technically, they're, you know, Russia is a nominal, God only knows exactly what kind of democracy, quote unquote, it is. And China certainly is not. But neither are they trying to push their ideology and change forms of government all around the world. They're busy just trying to figure out how they're going to continue to grow their economies. And that's a really fundamentally different situation that we face today than, say, you know, 30 years ago.
If you're talking about rising powers, and if a truly hostile superpower does emerge, or reemerge, I guess, a real and direct threat to the U.S., either militarily or ideologically, where is that likely to come from? Who's that likely to be?
I mean, I actually personally don't really see, at this point, the writing on the wall about which of these major powers could be a threat down the road, because I really firmly believe that the world that we're living in is one, the technological change and the impact of globalization has meant that non-state actors and countries that used to never had the ability to challenge major powers now have the means to do so because they can get their hands on nuclear technology. And we're seeing that, obviously, with, you know, terrorists in smaller states like Iran and the like. I actually think that those threats are going to be with us for a very, very long time. And 25 years from now, we will be wanting as many strong powers as possible because we're going to need them for the states that are stable, that are managing, you know, trying to manage and keep the world moving in a positive direction. There will be this banding together to stave off the forces of instability that are kind of creeping up all over the place.
You're talking about forces like Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda, and I mean, if you look in many, many countries and places, you know, even the situation in Kenya, which I find so unfortunate, the developments there, but you have lots of places that have instability lurking under the surface, Pakistan, Kenya, Venezuela, lots of places. States no longer can guarantee their own security. Right? You need other countries to help you protect your own country. And that is fundamentally new in the world, in the international system.
Thank you very much for speaking with us. It has been a pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you, Michelle.
That was Mona Sutphin and Nina Hachigian. They're authors of The Next American Century, How the U.S. Can Thrive as Other Powers Rise.
Let's talk next about an event that shapes the mindset of many people in Pakistan. People in that country, which is so important to the war on terror, often say they're embattled, and that's partly because they're next door to India. It's also partly because they once lost a huge section of what they considered their country. Bangladesh used to be called East Pakistan. That ended during a war for independence in 1971, and that war is the subject of the first novel by Tamima Anam. The book tells the story of a family led by a widow named Rahana, and the inspiration for that character was Anam's grandmother and the small but remarkable role she played in the war. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
The child of a diplomat, Anam grew up far away from her native Bangladesh, but she heard about the war for independence from her parents and their friends.
Even though we lived outside of Bangladesh, they told me so many stories about the war, and I found it incredibly exciting.
When she decided to write a novel about Bangladesh, Anam says she could not imagine writing about anything else except the war. But initially, she had a different kind of book in mind.
I thought I would write a sort of epic, very muscular narrative that had battle scenes and political rallies and all the sorts of big moments that you see in war novels. But actually, when I sat down to write, I ended up really thinking about what it was like for ordinary people to survive that war.
To research the story, Anam interviewed people who had lived through the war. In 1971, the long simmering hostility between East and West Pakistan began boiling over. Separated from West Pakistan by language, culture, and the expanse of India, East Pakistan, home of the Bengalis, chafed under the dominance of the West. When East Pakistan's Awami Party won an overwhelming victory in national elections, leaders in the West refused to allow a new parliament to convene. East Pakistani nationalists took to the streets to protest. Tamima Anam's mother, Shaheen, was 19 years old at the time.
We had no inkling that we'll go into a war, but we thought that if we demonstrate, if we protest, if we have rallies, if we have all these non-cooperation movements that we were doing, we are going to be able to convince them. So every day we were out in the street, we were talking, we were singing, we were, you know, having meetings, and it was very, very exciting.
In early March of 1971, at a massive rally in Dhaka, the leader of East Pakistan's majority party delivered a fiery speech calling on Bengalis to fight for their independence. In response to the unrest, the Pakistani army moved in on the 25th of March and began killing people indiscriminately. Shahidullah Khan, a young man at the time, was stunned and angered by the massacre.
I saw dead bodies and blood all over Dhaka. And we decided to go out, four of us, four friends together. We went out, and there's only one motto at that time. We have to liberate this country.
One of the four friends determined to liberate the country was Tamima Anam's uncle, Shaheen's older brother. He asked his mother if the resistance fighters could stay at her house and also asked if they could hide weapons in her garden. Khan says Tamima's grandmother was an unlikely candidate for the resistance.
I still remember when he first brought in the arms, and it was, we didn't tell her everything, but she sensed it. But at the same time, she allowed us to do because she was having the same, you can call it patriotism, you can call it the same ideas, everything. And she allowed us to do that. I thought it's incredible.
Tamima's grandmother provided food and shelter for these young fighters. While the young men went off on missions, Shaheen Anam stayed home. The atmosphere in the house, says Shaheen, was more exhilarating than terrifying. But one morning, the Pakistani army came looking for her brother.
I woke up a man standing just over me with a gun. I woke up, I opened my eyes, and I saw this man standing with a gun, and I said, you know, and it was amazing how calm I was. I said, please leave the room, I need to dress. So he left.
The family managed to survive that incident, but it is stories such as this that inspired Tamima Anam to write her book. The character Rahana, based on her grandmother, is a widow with two children. In this section, read by Tamima, Rahana's son Sohail comes to her to ask if she will allow a house she owns to be used for the resistance.
She wanted to be more angry and less proud, but she found herself wanting to say yes, not just so that she would have Sohail's confidence, but because she could not blame anyone but herself for making him so fine, so ready to take charge. This was who she had hoped he would become, even if she had never imagined that her son or the world would come to this.
Rahana's reasons for giving over her house are more complex than mere commitment to a cause. Early in the book, we learn that she once lost custody of her children. After she got them back, her devotion to them was boundless. That devotion is tested when, in the midst of war, Rahana falls in love. In the character of Rahana, Tamima says, she found a way to show what happens when war intrudes unexpectedly on the normal rhythms of life.
I suppose the idea that I had was that people brought their histories, their personal struggles, their familial struggles into that war. So it's not just that their political ideals motivate their participation in the war. They have all kinds of personal histories, especially Rahana. When she becomes a nationalist, all of these things kind of play into her actions and ultimately affect very, very deeply the decision that she takes at the end of the war and at the end of the book.
Tamima Anam's grandmother is still alive, and Tamima asked a friend to read the book to her. Tamima says it was slow going at first because her grandmother kept stopping to correct the facts.
She says, oh, I had four children, not two, during the war, and why has she changed my husband's name? But of course, when the love story came about, she was quickly quickly distanced herself from the character and said, oh, no, this is a work of fiction. That's really not me.
Anam says she worried about getting the story of the Bangladesh War right, both for those who lived through it and for her own generation who may not know much about it. And she says she hopes the book will be a way for other people to learn about Bangladesh. This native daughter who writes in English because she's not comfortable writing in the language of her own country is nonetheless determined to tell its story. A Golden Age is the first book in a trilogy Anam plans to write about her homeland. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
You'll find an excerpt from A Golden Age at npr.org/books. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the 286-horsepower TL Type S with a solar sensing climate control system. Learn more at Acura.com.